Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's Jesse Green here at the control panels as always, and I'm delighted to have you here for another episode. Now, our conversation today is, I believe, a really important one, and we're talking about the topic of well-being. As dentists, we look after so many people, whether it's our patients, our team, whomever it happens to be, but sometimes we need to also take care of ourselves. We need to take care of ourselves from a couple of different perspectives. Clearly, we need to take care of our body, our physical self, as we go through dentistry, making sure we can have a nice long career as a practicing dentist by not doing things to upset our musculoskeletal system. But equally and just as importantly, we want to take care of our emotional well-being. And my guest today is Annika Ball, and she is an absolute legend when it comes to taking care of oneself. She's obviously incredibly well known for the work she does in helping dentists achieve perfect posture from a working perspective and really making sure they take care of their physical well-being. But she's also really, really skilled in helping dentists take care of their emotional and spiritual well-being. And we're talking about this because I really believe that as dentists, we want to have a long career in dentistry. We want to be able to look after people. We want to be able to give our best selves to them. But all through that process, we can only give what we have. And that means from time to time, we need to be able to stop and pause and replenish ourselves. And this conversation talks about a wide variety of things that we as practitioners can do to take better care of ourselves and those around us. It's a really thought-provoking conversation. And what I really admire about Annika, apart from her obvious expertise, apart from her obvious experience in training people to sit better and work better, but what really impresses me mostly about Annika is her caring, her kindness, her desire to help, and it comes through in absolute spades in this conversation. She is a really nice person, really skillful person, really bright person, really insightful person, and she just wraps all that together with wonderful advice to help you take care of yourself so that you in turn can take care of others. So I hope you find this conversation as stimulating as I did, and I really hope you get some value out of it because I believe in this conversation particularly, this is a conversation we need to come back to time and time again. It's really important. So please do take care of yourselves and please do take action on the material that Annika shares. So here she is. Dr. Annika Ball, thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us at the Savvy Dentist Podcast. How are you today?
I am really well, and it's a pleasure to be talking with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, look, it's an absolute joy to be talking to you. I've been familiar with your work for many, many years. I've read lots of articles, and even as a younger dentist, I was always interested in the work you were doing because you've been a pioneer in the field of ergonomics and posture and well-being and trying to essentially preserve the longevity of dentists, which is, I think, wonderful work. So thank you for all the work that you do. I think it's really important work, and I'm looking forward to diving into a bit more of it today.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I'm absolutely driven by a passion to save my colleagues from suffering physically, mentally, emotionally, because a lot of it is preventable and it is possible to reduce the risk.
Well, I'm looking forward to touching on all of those things. Annika, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. We were out, and he said to me the other day, Jesse, being a dentist must be incredibly stressful. Usually the topic that comes up when you talk to your friends who are not dentists, they usually want to say either you earn a lot of money or be the highest suicide rate in the world. One of those two conversations seems to come up all the time. But I wanted to just talk about stress for a moment because it is a big factor in dentistry, whether we're dealing with our own stress, whether we're dealing with our patients' stress and anxiety, or indeed whether we're dealing with the stress and anxiety of our team. And so what I wanted to ask you about, particularly around stress to start with, was why do you think dentistry can be so stressful? What is the origin of that stress?
That's an interesting question. And Jesse, few people know the fact that I have been asking this question and looking into it for a long time. I was in fourth-year dental school at Melbourne University when I read about a research project done by Melbourne dental students a few years earlier. I think it was in the 60s. And they found that there was a high suicide rate, high morbidity rate, stress-related illnesses. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to graduate into such a stressful profession. And that spurred me on to learning ways of calming myself and calming my patients. And I think there are many reasons for this. One of them is that a lot of patients come to us and they would rather be anywhere but seeing us. And often I remember as a young graduate, I would have patients who said, nothing personal, doc, but I don't really want to be here. Well, unless you're trained not to take it personally, you do. And so I learned to look at it as, you know, when you go out into the rain, you get personally wet, but there's no intention for the rain to hit you only, and it's really not personal. And I started seeing the fearful patient behind the mask of that statement, or often people hide their fear, the patients hide their fear by putting on this somewhat hostile, prickly, difficult facade. Underneath that, there's a frightened person. So that's helpful. And I think our friends who are not in the dental profession don't understand what it's like to see patient after patient who are very frightened and cover it up. Also, we need to do very precise work on a moving target. Any second, as you very well know, the tongue moves, something happens. Of course, when I graduated, we're using amalgam and people could bite on that. When you ask, please don't bite on it. And then there's the time.
Marginal ridge goes.
Yeah, exactly. And you are running late. You have an emergency patient. And the time pressure and all of that, plus we're doing procedures that we need to keep on perfecting. And then there is the business of running a business. And then there are team members or staff that do whatever they do. So it's a multi-layered conglomeration of causes. And unless we are trained to recognize very early stress signs and practice intervention, we are in trouble.
It's a really interesting thought. And I've got quite a few questions running around my mind at the moment. And it's a bit like a jumper with lots of loose threads. I'm going to try and pull on one or two of them and see where we go. But I guess I'll start with a slightly different thought process than I thought I was going to start with. And I wanted to ask you, we understand these layers of stress, and I agree, it's very multifactorial, very layered, lots of things coming at you. And I wanted to ask you, because we live in the modern world now, we're almost wearing stress. You know, I'm so stressed, it's almost a badge of honor. Clearly, we know it's not great for one's health. We understand that. So I don't know if there's any studies, but are dentists relatively more stressed than other groups in the population, or is it just a perception?
Great question. I can't answer for certainty, but what I do know is that every so often when there are new studies released on the rate of suicide or stress or burnout among various professions, we seem to be very high on the list, whether it's number one or number two. I know that when I graduated, psychiatrists were on par with us. So yes, it is. I don't think it's just a perception, and it's nothing to be proud of. In fact, no. It's something that's very harmful to our well-being at so many levels and the quality of our lives.
Absolutely. And the irony of the psychiatrist being on that list is hard to escape as well, isn't it? The people who are meant to be looking after other people's well-being, much like dentists, we spend our lives looking after others, and we're the ones who take on other people's issues and feel the stress from that. There's a certain sense of sad irony around that. I wanted to ask you about stress signs, because there's obviously a baseline level of day-to-day living stress, but then that can go beyond, you know, what is normal, what is healthy, what is going to help us drive forward in our life. What are the, I guess, the signs around stress that we might identify first of all as we're going through this layering process, you know, because we can accommodate and accommodate and accommodate. But what things might we be accommodating, or what might we be experiencing that we think, this is a little red flag I need to pay attention to?
Yes. Well, unless you notice that something is going on, it's a little bit like if you don't have a smoke alarm, to alert you to the fact that there might be a fire, you don't know to call the fire brigade or pull out the fire hydrant. And I'm a metaphor person, so I like to talk in terms of recognizing the smoke alarm for yourself when you are stressed. And the only way you can know the contrast is, first of all, know what you feel like, what your body feels like, because the body gives you signs. It's like a barometer of how you feel when you feel good. So I get people to notice what their throat, chest, palm breathing is like, what their face looks like. For example, when you look into the rear vision mirror in the car, and then notice what all of those are like when, let's say, you're driving down a freeway and suddenly a car drives in front of you in the same lane without indicating. We all know what that feels like. Can you think of what that feels like for you?
I can, because I experienced it this morning.
Right. So what did you notice? Because this would be universal, I would say.
Oh, I noticed my heart rate went up. I noticed that I was on edge. I actually noticed, a bit embarrassed to tell you, I actually noticed I got a bit angry too. I was a bit frustrated. Come on, man, don't do that. And then I had to calm myself down and go, Jesse, just settle down a little bit.
And anger is response to something that's happened. And that's okay. However, you don't act on it. And some people do, and that's road rage. Sometimes people will notice that they'll get a sweaty palm. There might be butterflies in the stomach, for example, before giving. If you're not into loving public speaking, then you know what that feels like. So these are the various signs that I ask people that I train in this, in stress reduction techniques and skills, get familiar and know the difference. Because once you know that any of these signs are and symptoms are happening, then that will alert you. That's your smoke signal that it's time to do something. And it's a little bit like the air conditioning. When it's hot weather, you don't wait until it's 40 degrees in your office or home before you turn on the air conditioning. You turn it on when you notice that you're feeling a little bit warm and sweaty and uncomfortable. And the same with intervention and practicing calming and stress reduction techniques. The earlier you notice something's going on, the better it is for you to then reduce that.
I really love the early warning system. I like metaphors too, by the way. I think metaphors are great. And I kind of think of the whole tsunami metaphor. Obviously, we've seen lots of countries have some issues there. They've now got all these early warnings. And the reason I like the tsunami is sometimes for me, if I'm feeling stressed, it feels like a wave of emotion coming over me. And that's why I like that metaphor. It feels like a tsunami of stuff coming towards me and feeling overwhelmed and all the rest of it. I want to change gear just for a second. I will come back to that train of thought, but your background is really interesting. If I'm not mistaken, you grew up in Hungary, came to Australia as a teenager, obviously went through university a few years ago like I did, because I know we both did amalgam. So I know that we're dating ourselves as we say that. Probably the younger dancers are going, Malcolm, what is that? Do you know? I do remember those days of testing the occlusion and the marginal ridge breaking and all that sort of stuff. But I also remember around at university in particular, I always felt, and I don't know if you ever had this, and maybe it might just be unique to me, but I always felt at university when I was getting my work judged by the demonstrators, it was either perfect or wrong. It was very binary. It was great or it was wrong. And do you feel, Annika, that dentistry trains us to find fault is where I'm going with this. We see fault before we see what's right. And I don't know whether that's just me in my nature. I can see all the things around me, but I can focus in on that one thing that's not quite perfect. I wanted to ask you, do you notice that in dentistry as well?
Well, in my own training, we never even got good, let alone perfect. Everything was wrong.
Well, yeah.
And a lot of time we weren't even taught how to do it. We were sent off to the library to read up on it instead of being shown. Yes, I won't say any more about my training. Yes, so yes, I definitely know it in myself that I was always looking for what's wrong. And even when something was really right and my colleagues who saw my work or my patients would acknowledge and compliment me, I wouldn't actually let it in because I had such a loud inner critical voice in my ear that literally nullified any acknowledgement. And for a long time, nothing was good enough. And that caused me a lot of suffering. And I had to learn how to overcome that. And that's not to say that I didn't want to aim and I don't recommend aiming for excellence.
Of course.
However, listening to that inner critic and whipping ourselves for not being perfect is a recipe for suffering.
Do you think, Annika, that we take that perspective into a non-dental life as well? Do you think that we carry those traits into our personal lives?
Absolutely. I did that with my mothering. I was, even though I was an emigrant mother, but I was always looking for any imperfection. And I had to train later in life good enough and being kind and compassionate with myself, still aiming to be more effective, but that was different to setting a bar that I was always going to fail.
Good enough is so hard, though. I don't know about you, Annika, but I find it's taken me, I'm turning 50 this year. I seem to be referencing this in a lot of my conversations, but for me, that zero birthday has brought about lots of reflection. And obviously, as you go from being a young dentist in your 20s through your 30s and 40s and now in my 50s, is you notice some of those things changing. Perspectives change, your values change, not values, your priorities change. And it's taken me, I think, until now in my life to be able to embrace good enough. And so for those people who are a little younger than me, probably quite a lot younger than me, who may not yet have embraced good enough as being okay to contend with, how do you think it would be helpful to describe that feeling of good enough and being at peace with it? And then equally, how do you adopt that in your life?
That's a great question. And by the way, let me tell you, life doesn't begin until after 60. So you have a lot to look forward to.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to that too.
Yes. So this is a very interesting thread to take apart. The way I would talk about this with you is that instead of, let's say something happened, whether it was in a dental context or outside, but let's put it in the dental context. And I used to always put myself down. Even if I did a really good job, it was never good enough. And I would literally whip myself. I beat myself up. And then when I learned, and it didn't come easily, I actually learned to be kind and compassionate with myself. And then what happened was, whenever I thought I could do better next time, I would say something like, so I would acknowledge, first of all, that I did the best I could at, in that moment, given the circumstances, whatever. And that's not to say that we shouldn't do the best we can.
Of course.
But I learned to put my hand on my heart, literally, and say, well, sweetheart, I talk myself like this, you did really well, given whatever, and well done. And let's have a think how next time, what might I do different, or could I possibly do different and be more effective? But I wouldn't put myself down, and I would still be aiming high. And that is the difference between beating myself up or good enough, acknowledging myself, accepting and being respectful to myself. I was really disrespectful to myself when I was beating myself up, because none of us want to do a bad job in anything, especially in our work. We're so committed to doing good work. And life has become much sweeter since I'm doing this in every aspect of my life. I set myself high standards, but in a kind way, a loving way. I learned to love and respect myself. And that was not an overnight process.
No, definitely not. And because a lot of people listening to this show are going to be owning a dental practice as well, is it fair to say that until we can really be kind to ourselves and love ourselves, it's very hard to exhibit that for others as well? I guess what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to ask is, I know in my life, the perfectionism that I've had, which there's a lot of nature, a lot of nurture that led to my perfectionism, it served me in lots of ways, but it hindered me in other ways. And one of the ways it hindered me was my expectations of others were potentially unrealistic as well. As much as I would whip myself, I'd be expecting other people to meet impossible standards sometimes as well. So I wanted to ask about how that practice of self-care and speaking nicely to yourself, how that can impact on your leadership of your team and what it looks like when it's done well. Maintaining standards, but being compassionate.
Yes, that's actually well put. Maintaining standards and being compassionate. Because often people think that the way to be as good as you can is to whip yourself. And we now know through massive research that that's a kind of a negative parenting of ourselves and others. It doesn't work. There's a saying that we can only give away what we have ourselves. And if we don't have self-compassion, acceptance, and love, then no matter what words we use to reassure others that we are not judging them, they feel the fact that we are judging them, that we are harsh in some way. Even no matter what we do, people read the body language. They get that sense from us. So being really kind, and what I needed to do was literally, it's almost like brainwashing myself. Another metaphor I've used is, it's almost like you have a negative radio station playing. That's the critical inner voice that isn't kind at all. And I had to start a positive radio station. And I went through, I read it in one of the self-help books, Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life. You're familiar with that. And she said, keep on repeating as many affirmations as you wish, but my main ones were, I love and approve of myself. So I went through, I didn't believe it would work. It was just at a time when I was really suffering from my own judgment and criticism of myself. And I thought, what do I have to lose? So I would repeat it over and over and over again as I walked, as I was on a tram, whenever I could. And after about 6 weeks, an interesting thing happened. This was some years back. The positive radio station just played, and that was lovely. But then when there was a real, I'll call it a stuff up, you trip over or you drop something or definitely you did something, and even for a lot less than that, I would berate myself. Instead of the negative radio station, the positive one came on, and automatically I heard this, I love and approve of myself, and I was amazed. And to this day, no matter what's going on, and it doesn't mean that I don't reflect on how I could do something better and more effectively, but the positive radio station comes on. I love and approve of myself. And that has opened up this gentleness and kindness. I have done other things as well. And also I had the really good advice of talking to myself as if I was talking to a little 5-year-old who fell over and hurt her knee. I wouldn't scream at her for being silly, for falling over. I would kiss that knee and be kind. And I started talking to myself as if it was to that little girl. So I've used various techniques, but that was the real breakthrough technology for putting in a positive radio station, because we have these conversations. It's almost like software. What software do you want to have? And it's hard to delete the negative radio station, so it's a voiceover.
I love that. I really appreciate you sharing that story because I think it's so real. And there's a lot of us walking around with a negative radio station in our heads, and it takes practice and training to replace that radio station, to change the channel, to tune into a different frequency. And I guess from there, as you said, you can't give what you don't have. So once you're kind to yourself, it allows you to be compassionate with others. Could I ask you a question? And this is perhaps a loaded question. In your own world with business you run and other things that you do, if you see someone else who is not quite performing at the standard that you'd expect of them, on a practical level, how do you address that with love and kindness and still wanting to hit that standard or maintain a certain level of performance? Could you just speak to that for a moment? Because I think what some people are going to struggle with or potentially identify with is, how do I do that without lowering my standard? I'm happy, the kindness part I understand, but how do I do that and maintain the standard?
With someone else.
Yes, with someone else.
Yes. So before I answer that, I'd like to just say that I was a practice owner some years ago, and I had the good fortune to learn to do what's called the, I think it was called the discriminating interview. Or so what I learned was that some lovely people weren't right for the job, or some people who on paper had a wonderful CV didn't actually like people, and they don't belong into a dental office unless they do admin away from patients. So the first question is this person right match for the practice? Because I've seen that time and time again. If that person isn't, I would just say, and I had to do a lot of that once I learned that we had a whole lot of people who weren't right for the practice. And I just tell them what a wonderful person you are. However, and I'm happy to recommend you in areas that suit your skills. However, this is not a match or whatever way. And people don't like hearing that, but there are some skills that you cannot teach. And yes, as you would know. So it's important for practice owners to distinguish and decide whether the person that isn't quite performing as they would like to, are they actually working in their strengths? Because often they're not. Now, if they are working in their strengths, then I find that just sharing my passion and my intention for what I'm doing, and I'd love them to work with me on that. And I wondered whether they feel comfortable in doing that, or is there anything that perhaps stops them from doing that? Is there something in their personal life? Sometimes people come to work and they're leaving behind a very ill partner or parent, or there's a whole lot going on and they can't do any better. So I might have a conversation, and I find that by sharing about myself or talking about somebody else, who that's called one step removed therapy, a story about somebody, it can even be made up. Because sometimes it's too confrontational to ask a direct question, is there something going on in your life? Rather saying, I have worked with dental assistants who tried their best. However, they had so much going on outside the clinic that they were struggling to perform the ways that I know they were capable of, which then opens the door for them to share, well, actually. So it's a kind, loving, and spacious conversation. However, there is something else that I do. And I do this, by the way, I did this before this interview, and certainly before I run a workshop, a presentation, or having this kind of important conversation, is that before I approach anything like what I listed, I actually do a little, I might do a mini meditation, or just express a wish and an intention for my ego to step aside. I call it a preparation meeting with myself, where I say, may I be of service, may I be of contribution, may I be a space for compassionate listening, may my ego step aside, so that I approach with that intentionality, which I've found every time that it changes things. If I go into it without preparation of that kind, it might only take me a minute or half a minute. I might stay in my car before I get out of my car and go into an important meeting and do this. And people have told me that even though the conversation might have been tricky or difficult, they really felt that they had space to be and they were accepted. And I would listen by coming back to myself and being really present.
Wow. What I'm hearing in that, Aniko, what I'm hearing coming through really clearly is kindness. Yeah. And kindness to yourself, kindness to others. And I really, really resonate with that. Kindness is obviously something that you exhibit and display. I would hazard a guess is probably one of your core values somewhere in amongst all those things. And it comes through. I love that. I wanted to just inquire a little bit. I know you've done a lot of different training outside of your traditional dental training. So obviously you've got your dental degree and so on and so forth. But you've also done a lot of work in hypnosis. You've done a lot of work in the Alexander method as well. And before we get into the physical work that you're so well known for, is around posture and ergonomics and longevity of career, which we will absolutely touch on, I do want to just talk a little bit about hypnosis and the role it's played in your practicing life. And because sometimes when we think of hypnosis, we think of the stopwatch swinging on the chain and, you know, dancing around like chickens on stage or, you know, whatever. And of course, that's not what we're referring to. We're talking about clinical hypnosis and other things. I wanted to ask you, firstly, if you could just help people understand who may be less familiar with what clinical hypnosis can do and what it actually is. Could you just walk us through a bit of an overview of what that involves?
Yes, well, I actually trained in self-hypnosis already as a teenager, as you can imagine, coming from communist Hungary, not speaking more than 5 words of English was very difficult. And so to help me through a very difficult time, I trained in self-hypnosis, and that got me through exam pressures and really helped. And then in my fourth year of dentistry, when I realized that I was going to graduate into such a stressful profession, I trained in hypnosis so that I could use it on my patients. What I found was that the traditional hypnosis, which is known as listen to my words and do as I say and close your eyes, I didn't find it as applicable to dentistry. Fortunately, a couple of years after graduating, and I was about to walk away from that kind of very traditional hypnosis, I came across an indirect or conversational hypnosis based on Milton Erickson, the famous American psychiatrist who was the father of this approach. And that's what is really easy to use. And I actually teach this to dentists within my courses because, for example, now if I slow my speaking and I have gaps and my voice tone is like this, that in itself is very, very relaxing. So you can talk. Can you sense that there is just talking like this?
Can.
Yeah.
And I felt myself sink into my chair a little bit more.
Exactly. So, and I'm really emphasizing this because some dentists ask me if they should do a hypnosis training course, and I say, don't bother, because I can now teach in a short time that just slowing down, having poses, it's called the pregnant pose, and next to the patient's ear, I would take an audible breath and sigh it out. That is so calming. The only downside is that the dental assistant might go into a trance. And that happened a lot. And there are some really simple ways of telling a story to a patient and getting them to visualize things that absolutely make the dental experience very pleasant. So you can use your voice. And in fact, anytime, even in a meeting, if the whole meeting is heated and everybody is shouting, if you start speaking a little bit slower, it brings the temperature down. So I have some very simple techniques that I no longer call necessarily hypnosis unless we call it, and it is conversational hypnosis. You're using your voice tone, your pacing, your breathing, and storytelling as tools for making the person more comfortable. And often my patients would say, I should pay you double, one for my dental treatment and one for the relaxation. And of course, they can take away tools to use in their own lives.
I think that's fantastic. I can't let the conversation move on without reflecting back on what we started on, talk about hypnosis. When you came to Australia, you said you had 5 words of English. And I just wanted to ask you, this is my own personal curiosity, how was that experience and what led you to learn that self-hypnosis to get you through that? Because did someone introduce you to that or did you stumble across that yourself? I'm curious, that's not in my, well, I'm not sure, but I would imagine that's not a typical teenage experience to discover hypnosis at such a young age.
No, well, I had a very difficult background and coming from communist Hungary, and there were a lot of deaths in my childhood, and then capitalist Australia, it was very difficult and I was suffering. And then I saw a movie called, I think it was The Three Faces of Eve, something about multiple personality disorder, and the psychiatrist in the movie used hypnosis. And then I picked up a book in a bookstore on self-hypnosis, and I thought this could help me. I needed to help myself because it was, I felt like I had dropped him from Mars into Melbourne, and it was really tough. Learning English was not as difficult as somehow fitting in and dealing with everything. So I would, for example, I hated chemistry and physics, and I had terrible teachers. And the way I made myself study chemistry and physics, and I got honors in them, I mean, to get into dentistry, you had to do well, is I would get up, I would hypnotize myself and give myself post-hypnotic suggestions that when I get up from this, I'm going to love learning my physics and chemistry. And it worked.
Wow. This sounds like it's been, obviously, what I'm taking away from this conversation, Annika, is that you're so well known in the space. Everyone knows who you are. Everyone knows, or at least has an understanding or an appreciation of the work that you do, if not necessarily in all the detail. But what I'm hearing is this is the culmination of a lifelong process here. This is not, I just learned a couple of things and went out and started teaching them. This has been a journey that you've been on for many years, since you've been a teenager.
Yes.
That's really, really interesting, that depth of experience. And I guess the other thing I wanted to ask you around this, and this is a question I had not planned to ask, and if it's not okay to ask, I'm okay if you pass on it. But I wanted to ask you about processing trauma, because you mentioned to me that you'd left hungry, there'd been lots of deaths in your family, and for anyone, that's traumatic. But as a teenager, that's probably, you haven't quite developed, perhaps the frontal lobe is still under development, perhaps the brain is still growing, developing, emotions are still being figured out. There's a lot of people in the world that will have been through some traumatic experience, perhaps not as significant as that, but a lot of people carry around trauma. How can we use these skills to process that and move forward through that? I understand that psychology is perhaps not your background, but I'm just interested to know your personal thoughts or views on that.
Thank you for asking that question, and I'm happy to answer. Although I'm not trained as a psychotherapist, I've actually looked into a lot of healing, and I did a lot of healing of my own trauma. And in fact, my loss and death started happening when I was 6 years old. So, and back then, there were no trauma therapists. The grief counseling wasn't known, and certainly not in Hungary. And it was much later in life that I learned grief. Actually, I am a trained grief counselor, loss and grief counselor, and I did a lot of my own healing. So I recommend to anyone, even sometimes people think that you have to have major traumas, and many of us have major traumas. Sometimes even the smaller traumas, if they weren't talked about at the time, if no one actually recognized that you were suffering, and often we don't recognize, and we just learn to push on and get on with it and put on a mask and the stiff upper lip, then the trauma is sitting in our cells. In fact, a lot of researchers are now saying in mind-body medicine that your biography becomes your biology. So that it's sitting in the cells, in the cellular memory. And for that reason, just talking about it later on is not enough on its own, because that's just going around. And that is helpful, talking about it, but that's in the mind. The trauma is actually sitting in the body. So somatic psychotherapy, which is talking and also working with what's stored in the body, is an important way to heal past trauma and to be recognized. And there are a lot of, there's a lot of work being done, and there is a growing number of somatic therapists and trauma therapists these days everywhere. And I recommend that kind of healing. And I did a multitude of that, some with someone's help, a lot of it with having read books and listening to lots of workshops and podcasts and various ways using Western and ancient Eastern wisdom to release all that so that I can live in the present, because whatever is sitting in the, in our system does drive us without us realizing at an unconscious level. And we don't have the freedom to be.
Thank you for answering that. I really appreciate you taking the time and being open to that, because I think that there's a lot of people, as you say, carrying around various degrees of trauma. It doesn't have to be major, but I think having some skills and some places to turn to or some resources to look for helps a lot of people. You gave me a really lovely segue a moment ago, and I'm, with your permission, I'm going to take it. And you mentioned that your biography becomes your biology. And so I guess this is our segue into the physical work that you do with posture and other things as well. We're carrying stress around. It no doubt shows up in our posture. It no doubt shows up in how we carry ourselves. So I wanted to ask you about the physical elements of dentistry, just as a little bit of background without boring you or our listeners too much. When I was a younger dentist, I had frozen shoulder. I was recommended to have all sorts of shoulder surgery, and I ended up not having that and doing yoga instead and trying to get my mobility back through that. But I think it would have been very easy for me to have gone down that path, and goodness knows what may have happened as a result. Might have all been fine, might not have been. But I was 34 or 5, I think, you know, maybe 33 even when that happened. And so I was really only 10 years into my career. And that's a short, that's not much of a career if you're getting those kind of musculoskeletal issues. And I was very seriously thinking I might have to give up dentistry at that point. Do many people have that experience, or is that just one off?
I wish I could say it was one off. Unfortunately, what I'm finding is that the dentists who are contacting me desperate for help and contemplating leaving the profession, not because they don't love it, but they don't think they can continue for the reasons you spoke of, who are in a lot of pain, are getting younger and younger. I expect that the older dentists to flock to my courses, and it's actually the very young dentists, and even dental students are contacting me. So there is a massive problem. And I believe the reason is that when we learn to do what we do on a tooth in our patient's mouth, we don't learn. Perhaps there is a dental school somewhere, I'd like to think, but I don't know if there is, where students learn how do you get your pair of hands, eyes in there so that you can do your work, and what should you do and not do with your shoulders and spine to reduce the risk of injury. So like everyone else, I remember twisting myself into a pretzel, not giving a moment's thought to my body, to myself. It was almost as if I was a disembodied pair of hands, eyes, and brain. And I delved in and did the work. And then, of course, it gets worse as you go into private practice and time pressure and running a practice. And so I was in pain from the time I was a dental student. And this is what I see. And something that you may be shocked to hear is that it seems to me that young dentists are in more pain earlier than the older dentists, which I believe is due to two reasons. One, magnification loops. They have to get by magnification loops while students, and they are not designed properly. And also, most of them have been bending their spine down towards their mobile phone from a young age, even before they got into dental course. And the spine is not designed to do that.
Yeah.
And possibly a third reason, that perhaps the dental students are not as active in outdoor sports as some generations ago. I think that might be a part of it as well, but it's more the first two reasons. So we have a massive problem.
It's really interesting. And I don't know if this is a factor or not, Annika. So please, open to you saying, no, Jesse, you're speaking through your hat. We joked a moment ago about you and I doing amalgams and all the rest of it. Amalgam was a very forgiving material compared to some of the more modern materials. Do you think the changes in material science and techniques is having any impact in that problem of musculoskeletal issues at all?
Perhaps the complexities might add to the mental stress and difficulty. I think procedures have become more complex, and the need for dentists to keep up to date with more and more developments, because earlier we're giving away our age, which we have already given away, but cavity preparations and materials didn't change for 50 years at one point, and then they changed every few years, and now it's a constant evolution. So there's probably more demand. And I think there's another layer, social media. Young dentists are seeing master dentists post on dental Facebook groups their very best work. And then, of course, your critical inner voice is going to have a field day.
Yes. Yeah.
And one of the most wonderful things that one of the admins of DPR did not too long ago was he actually talked about failures, things that didn't work. And we all have them. We just don't talk about it.
Which is great. So let's just talk about those physical problems that people have. And I know that people should definitely go and attend your course and get an in-depth understanding of that. But just really quickly, what are the common mistakes when it comes to setting oneself up for work? What are the most common mistakes that people make? Is it, as you say, the magnification? Is it sitting in the chair properly? Is it the type of chair? What sort of issues, culprits mainly? A couple of headline ones.
So the first one is that most dentists don't realize that unless they're working with a microscope or refractive loops, which are like a mini microscope, you cannot sit upright and hope to look into a patient's mouth without neck damage.
Right.
There's only a 10 degree freedom at the top of the spine, which is at the height of the ears, to look down. So you need to transport your torso slightly forward, pivoting at the hip joint. So that's the first thing. And you need to sit on your sit bones on a firm seat. So a lot of dental stools are not well designed. The dental chair should be as thin as possible. I talk about inner and outer ergonomics. What you're doing inside, how you organize yourself, is your inner ergonomics. And everything but you in the surgery is the outer ergonomics. So there are some outer ergonomic challenges, and a lot of so-called ergonomically designed equipment isn't. The other big mistake is that most dentists will lean, for example, a right-handed dentist will lean to the right. Gravity is always vertical. So leaning to the right, the spine is not designed for that. Gravity is acting unevenly. I say to dentists, move your stool, move the patient, move the chair, ask the patient to turn their head, but do not twist your spine or lean off to the right or left because you're doing yourself harm. And the next big one is most dentists are raising their non-dominant shoulder and elbow. So for most dentists, that will be the left side. And the muscles that move the shoulder and arm are movement muscles not designed for lengthy contractions. So they're going to have sore shoulders. So if I said to you, and you'll see what I'm doing, but for listeners, if I raise my arm and hold it like this, even for a few minutes, let alone hours, you know that you'd have a sore shoulder. When we do a little lift of the shoulder and elbow, it doesn't look like a full raise of the arm, but it's the same thing as far as the movement muscle activation is concerned. These are not muscles designed to hold up the arm against gravity. Also, holding the mouth mirror hovering away without proper finger rest, where we're actually releasing the weight of the arm, again, is a recipe for shoulder pain. So these are some of the very common problems that I see. There's more, but depending on how much time you'd like to spend on this.
Well, it's really interesting. I was talking to years ago when I told you I had those shoulder issues, and I was describing it to an older dentist, and he had had his own shoulder problems, and I don't know if he'd ever seen you, but he said to me, I bet you it's your mirror. And I went, absolutely, yes. It was my mirror. And I was surprised that he knew that so well, and I was surprised to have had that realization, and you've just given me the reason why it was my mirror arm. So thank you for completing that loop for me. When people are setting up their surgery, what sort of physical design factors do you think make a difference that allow for a good working environment? Is there anything in particular in the construction of the surgery that needs to be considered?
Yes, having space around the dental chair is really important. And can you believe that the one measurement that's not in the guidelines of the Dental Association, they have guidelines on everything, including the kitchen sink, is the space around the dental chair. So what I mean by that is that when the patient chair is fully supine, horizontal, there needs to be something like 70 to 90 centimeters around the chair so that you can, the dentist or clinician can move back enough to be able to pivot forward a little bit at the hip joint. And there are practices where there isn't enough space behind the patient. And the closer, that's another common problem that I see, is that dentists are sitting so close to the patient chair that the cloth of their uniform is touching the edge of the headrest. And that means that the only way you can look into the patient's mouth is to bend your spine.
Yes.
And the spine gliding joints are not designed for lengthy bending. And there have been a couple of dentists who I advised when they contacted me or they did my courses and said, Aniko, there's not enough room for me to move back a fraction because I teach people to move back a fraction. I said, unless the practice can make changes for you, I recommend you leave the practice because that's career suicide to stay. And a few dentists have actually resigned because they were working in surgeries that were substandard. And I've tried to influence the ADA to include that in the guidelines, and I haven't been successful so far.
Fingers crossed. Maybe this podcast will go a little way to helping that as well. So if ADA, if you're listening, please let's get these guidelines sorted out.
So that's one of them, and there are some others as well.
So Aniko, there'll be people listening to the show who, as I said, many are practice owners, some not. But in terms of physical self-care and looking after our body, and whether it's stretching or yoga or other things, what sort of things can we do to prepare for the day? And what sort of things can we do between patients? Or what sort of things can we do at the end of the day to keep our body in the best working order possible?
That's a very important consideration. Some dentists don't get up for hours. And my recommendation, strong recommendation, is that even if you have a very long appointment, and I know that some crown and bridge preparation appointments are long, just give the patient a few minutes rest, even 1 minute, and you getting up and moving your body is worth it. And it's a good rest for the patient as well. And it's just standing up, even if you can't leave the room, if you've got room to do, I say to dentists, find your inner hula girl or hula boy and do a mad kind of shake and move your hips and dance behind the patient. You can dance in front of the patient and the patient will think you are the coolest dentist on earth. Or go out of the room and just move your body. Also very important for eye health to take off glasses, magnification loops, and look at distance near and far, use your peripheral vision, look into natural light, look at sky greenery, and that's very good for you. If there is time, and certainly at lunchtime, I recommend taking a yoga mat if you've got the space, and you can do some gentle stretches even without a yoga mat. But what I do recommend, and any of the listeners can go to optimumdentalposture.com website. And on the homepage, if you scroll down, there is a question, what is active rest? If you click on that, you will find instructions and illustrations showing you and guiding you to what's called the active rest, where you lie down and release compression of joints, decompress the spine. It's mentally, physically, emotionally calming. And practices that I've trained in ergonomics and wellness workshops, they do that at lunchtime and certainly after work, because this is a really good way to undo the damage of the stresses, the fact that gravity is acting on you as a downward force all day, and helps to repair some of the damage that we have sustained just by doing what we do.
I really appreciate that. It's really practical, really useful.
Walking, moving, also in between patients or whenever possible, because we're so forward-oriented with our arms, rotating the arms backwards is really helpful. And just doing some side swinging and stretches, but not a forceful stretch, but rather releasing into lamp kind of stretch, which is different. It's a gentle, slower stretch, which is actually more effective because it gives time for the muscles and fascia to release.
Okay, excellent. If we get these things right, if we can do these sorts of exercises, practice the physical self-care coupled with the mental well-being that we spoke earlier about, is it fair to say that we are now helping to alleviate a lot of those stresses and strains that we spoke about at the very top of the podcast when we spoke about, you know, why people are so stressed, where's the origin of it? Is it fair and reasonable to say that if we can handle those things, we're going to increase the longevity of someone's career, or at least put them in the best possible chance of having a long career?
Oh, absolutely. And I need to tell you that in 2019, I was presenting at the Adelaide Congress and I gave a topic, overcoming and preventing occupational chronic pain. And the organizing committee changed that to inner ergonomics, a practical recipe for career longevity. And that, right, that was what they thought. Well, 200 dentists came along and listened. I do believe that that is the recipe for improved quality of life and career longevity. I also recommend that dentists look at ways of decluttering their day. So I consider part of self-care is to possibly work on longer appointments, having a little bit of time in between patients, because we are going to be more productive when we're not under the pump. So it may mean that you are strategic about your appointment book and caring for yourself and prioritizing you. And often people say, oh, Nico, that sounds a bit like I'm being selfish. And I say, no, that's extreme self-care, because you only have one precious you. And my motto, which you probably saw in most of my articles and postings, is take care of yourself. You are your most precious instrument. And I often see dentists take better care of their cars and their handpieces than of themselves.
And the other thing I would say to that is also take better care of their patients as well.
Yes.
In addition to that. And one of the things with dentists and all healthcare providers, we get into healthcare because of the care part. But that care needs to extend to oneself as much as anyone else or anything else. And I really appreciate that message. I think it's a really important message. Annika, you've been incredibly generous with your time today. It's been a really fascinating interview. It's very intellectually stimulating for me to have a conversation with you, because there's so many things that we could talk about. And we've been able to tap into a rich vein of around self-care. We've been able to tap into emotional well-being. We've been able to talk about dealing with past traumas. And of course, we've been able to talk about the physical elements of maintaining good posture throughout your dental career. On a personal note, I just really want to say how much I've enjoyed talking to you. So thank you so much for what I consider a really fun conversation. I really hope you've had a good time, and I really hope that our listeners enjoy this conversation too. So your work is incredible. For anyone who wants to come and hear you speak or do some courses with you, what would be the best way for them to reach out to you, please?
Through my Optimal Dental Posture website. Also, I'm on Facebook. There's an Optimal Dental Posture Facebook page, and dentists can reach out to me and I will respond. And often I have conversation with them to find out what their concerns are, and I tailor make workshops for them. Right now I am offering a blended training for Victorian dentists, where some training will be online and some in person. For interstate dentists right now, I'm only offering online training. And one of the silver linings of the pandemic was, Jesse, that it forced me to explore the outer limits of what's possible online. And I must say that I've come up with ways of doing some very successful practical training in dentist-owned clinics, which I didn't think I could do. So that's where I am right now, given the COVID-safe way of operating.
It's been fascinating. I would never have wished COVID upon anyone, and I'm sorry for anyone who's had an adverse experience with COVID. But the gift of COVID is it forced some innovation upon us as well, and some different thinking and how we overcome things. And like you, we've had to adapt to that as well. So ladies and gents, if you'd like to find out more about Annika and her work, please do reach out to her via her website or on Facebook or the other social media channels. I really commend her work to you. And if you want to have a long career in dentistry, if you want to have a fun and enjoyable and sustaining career in dentistry, I think you just got to do this stuff. I think it's a non-negotiable. I think you just got to get on and do this stuff. So, Monica, thank you once again for being part of our conversation today.
Oh, thank you, Jesse. I've really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.